Hello, everybody. Welcome to this new podcast interview in the East Asian Books Network, which is part of the New Books Network. Today, my guest is Ronald Loftus, who is the author of The Turn Against the Modern, The Critical Essays of Tauka Reyung, which was published by the Association for Asian Studies in 2017.
Yes, sir.
Hello, Ronald.
And hello, Roman.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I would like to start with a question about yourself, not
yes.
about the book, but about yourself. How did you become interested in the field of Japanese studies or Asian studies?
Yes, that's in a way a surprisingly more difficult question than it should be. But I grew up mostly out of the United States because of my father's work. So we spent, when I was 5 years old, we went to India. Then we were in Europe for a few years, and then we finished up in Bangkok, Thailand, where I graduated from high school. So I'd had this experience in third world countries and in Europe, and when I came back to go to college in the United States, I really didn't know what I was interested in. I kind of gravitated towards international politics and things, and I thought I could draw upon my experience on Southeast Asia. But I got advice, probably good advice, that if one was going to specialize in Asian studies, it perhaps should be East Asia, the big countries of Japan and China. And at that time, the late 60s, China was not a place that you could actually go to. So my whole understanding of being an Asianist was that you go there and you immerse in the language and culture. So I picked Japan for those reasons. And so I was finishing a master's in international studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and I had a course with a professor who had been Edwin Reischauer's assistant when he was in the embassy here, and he got me very interested in Japan. It was the whole modernization thing, and so I then went to Claremont Graduate School and started studying Japanese history. And Professor Peter Deuce came to be a professor there, and he was my mentor, and the rest is history, as we say.
Okay. So you wrote this book about Tauka Reyung,
yes.
who's a Meiji period thinker,
yes.
philosopher. How did you meet?
Yes.
How did you find Tauka Reyung, and how did you come up with this, with the idea for this book?
Yes. Well, in a way, Roman, the book has been with me for a long time because it was definitely part of my dissertation project. So I came to Japan, and things in those days, this would be the early 70s, were a bit behind where we are today. My language preparation was not as high as young people today are able to. And so I was just starting out, struggling, and people said, if you're interested in Meiji history, you know, you have to read Hirokawa Daikichi, Meiji Seishin, Meiji no Seishin, and Kano Masanao, his book called Shihonshugi Keisei Ki no Chitsujo Ishiki, the consciousness of order during the time of the founding of capitalism. So they were encyclopedic kind of works. Hirokawa was very much into the Jiyūmin-ken Undo and into Kitamura Tōkoku, but he had about 10, 15 pages on Tauka Reyung. And Kano Masanao, in his very encyclopedic work, also had 10 or 15 pages on Tauka Reyung. And I learned from those books that Ienaga Saburo had written a little Iwanami Shinsho book that kind of sold for 50 yen at some point in the 50s. And it was called Tsukinaru Shisoka no Shogai Tauka Reyung no Shiso, whatever, no Hito to Shiso. So I read Ienaga's work. I got a chance to meet him, and I studied with Kano Sensei at Waseda University for a while. And then Nishino Masaru was a Hosei University literature person. So Kano, of course, was more like shisoshi or intellectual history. And Nishida was a straight-up literature man, but he ran a senior seminar at Hosei Dainaku on Tauka Reyung, and he was the compiler of Tauka Reyung Zenshu, the complete works. So I studied with Nishida Sensei. He was an excellent mentor. He pushed me really hard and taught me how you've got to, you know, push and dig for materials. And I was a bad student because I let him dig for the materials, but I benefited very much from his work. He just finished volume 6 of Talkuda and Zenshu. It was a projected 8 volumes. He's been working on it for 50 years. He joked with me recently and said, I never thought it would take 50 years to complete this, complete works. But each time he puts out a volume, he goes through the writing so carefully. And usually there's a, you know, there are 400 or 500 pages, and 100 pages at the end is notes and explanatory things. So it's real deep scholarship. And, you know, I'm just coming in and taking advantage of the great work that he has done. And he's been, he retired from Jose probably 10 or 15 years ago, but we've maintained contact. And he lives in Chiba, Ken, and Urayasuchi. We walked around Urayasu stuffing mailboxes with Green Party leaflets and so. He's a great eccentric sort of guy. He goes to China a lot. He loves, he studies the, also the colonial literature that Japan produced in Manchuria and Taiwan and so forth. So he's a great scholar and friend. So between those influences, Ienaga Saburo, Kano Masanao, Hirokawa Daikichi, and Nishida Masaru, I sort of began my Talkuden Kenkyu, my Talkuden studies. And, you know, I realize now, since I've stayed with it now for almost 40-some years, that when I was younger, I just was not well enough equipped to appreciate what I was reading. And now I feel that's why I wanted to write this book, because now I feel like, yes, now I kind of get it. I get what he was doing. There weren't the categories to help me in 1972, 73, 74 to really understand what I was reading. And, you know, I kept thinking that I better understand what kind of category Talkuden belongs in. Was he a socialist? Was he a, he didn't seem to be an avid Marxist, though he mentioned Marx. He liked Engels. But I couldn't tell what slot he belonged into. And that sort of bothered me as a young scholar. I thought, I should understand this, and I should be able to say he's this or he's that. But I realized as I got more mature that, no, some people don't really resist categorization, and that's their beauty, that's their charm, and that's what we can learn from.
Your book is, you say in the introduction that this is a biography.
Yes.
Of, Talkuden.
Yes.
Talkuden.
Yes.
But I had the feeling, reading the book, I had the feeling that it's so much more. It's not, I mean, your perspective is the perspective of a historian.
Yes.
But there's so much more in the book. There's, you talk about philosophy.
Yes.
You talk about, modernity, and a lot of different other, topics.
Yes. That,
and my question is, in the introduction, you mentioned Berman.
Yes.
There's a, if I may
Marshall
quote.
Berman.
Yeah. You talk about, so you quote from Berman, you say, to become modern is to find ourselves in an environment that promises us adventure, power, joy, growth, transformation of ourselves and the world, and at the same time, that threatens to destroy everything we have, everything we know, everything we are. And then you say that this is, This quote from Berman's perspective,
yes,
is like a lens,
yes,
for you through,
yes,
which you try to better understand,
yes,
and grasp,
yes,
what was happening in Meiji Japan.
Yeah, I think so. Thank you for noticing that. And the way I work, so like, yes, if I'm going to write about someone who was so-called anti-modern, Han Kindai Shugisha, that's how, you know, Ienaga labeled Talkuden, and actually Kano and Hirokawa also, they considered him at least anti-Bunmei, if not anti-modern. So I thought, well, what is becoming modern? What is modernism? What is modernity? And you, again, the literature was not rich. It didn't exist in the early 70s. And when I began working this book, I didn't find it extensive. But a critic like Marshall Berman, yes, I think I felt like Talkuden would understand very well. He felt, I think, very deeply that things were tumultuous in his day, that things were whirling around him and other people couldn't see it, and that he was concerned about it. Sometimes his stance as a writer was to be very shrill, very tough, very, they call him surudoi in Japanese, very penetrating and probably annoying to his readers. Because he was very passionate about Chinese philosophy and ancient China when he went to Tokyo Bunka Daigaku, the predecessor of Tokyo Imperial University, he went to the Chinese Studies Department, and he immersed in Chinese studies, and he loved Laozi and Chuangzi and the I Ching and so forth. So his writing style, you know, it's Meiji Japanese, but it's also very Sinified. You know, he loves kanji characters that aren't the ones that we see every day. And that was a real struggle for me when I started reading him. I was too young to really know what was going on. And so I think that he could be this kind of, he had this aggravated stance, this unhappy position. I included that picture, you know, where he looks like he's pissed off at the world. And so, yeah, I think he understood that, you know, there is so much promise in modernity, but it is also taking away with the other hand what it's offering with one hand. And that really bothered him. He kept trying to say, pay attention to this, to, you know, his fellow Japanese, but in the 1895, you know, until his death in 1912, there wasn't a great many Japanese who wanted to hear what he had to say.
You're actually talking the book about the fact that at the time, most of the intellectuals, they were reading the new Western canon.
Yes.
The fundamental texts. And at the same time, Reyon he became an Asianist.
Right.
And you mentioned how he starts to reread Zhuangzi and so on and so forth. Yes. Why did that happen? Is that a paradox in a way? Is he part of a larger group of people who did that?
I think he had some friends who did that. Most of them were, I think, much more conservative than he was. So there was some people who turned to ancient Chinese thought because they thought it really substantiated a kind of imperial model or imperial bureaucratic state, a strong central government. But I think Tao Kordain, he was much more towards the Taoist side of the sort of the free independent thinker who wasn't tied to systems. He always said that thing about, I don't like isms, you know, this should be or that should be. No, I don't care for that. And am I a socialist? He said, well, I've always felt great sympathy, you know, with the downtrodden and the poor. And he wrote about the people who were, you know, living in tenement housing, the early industrial proletariat. He sympathized with them. And, you know, he was making his living as a literary critic right after the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-95. So I think what he did was, I mean, he could have been like a philosopher or something else, but he was getting paid to read literature and think about it. So he was trying to get a group of writers to pay attention to the situation of the poor in Meiji Japan. This is the issue that you should get into, and you should write novels that are passionate and full of ideals that show that life doesn't have to be like it's turning out in Meiji Japan. So he tried to push writers like Hirotsu Yudo and others to, let's make this problem the stuff of our fiction, the stuff of our novels. And he seemed to want to have a Japanese writer who was the equivalent of Victor Hugo in France, someone who would rally people to causes of what we call social justice today, you know, in a broad sense.
But at the same time, so he did become an Asians,
yes.
But at the same time, he was well-versed, well-read in Western thought as well.
Exactly.
There's a whole chapter in your book dedicated to Schopenhauer,
right.
And Reyon's reading of Schopenhauer. Yes. Right?
And he wrote that piece. It's kind of long title. It sounds better in Japanese. I think it's Jukyu Seiki ni Okeru Toyo no Shiso. No, it must be Seiyo no Jukyu Seiki ni Okeru Toyo no Shiso. So like the state of in contemporary Europe, what they're saying and thinking about traditional Asian thought. And he was, again, I think, like you say, he was supposedly anti-modern. No one ever called him anti-Western, but, you know, presumably he's more interested in Asian thought, so you think, okay, he's not well-read in Western thought, but not at all. He did his homework, and in that essay, he ran through all these people, which when I first read that essay in the early 70s, I didn't know who Anquetil Duperron was. And I didn't know who all these people were, the Royal Asiatic Society, Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophists. Maybe I'd heard of her, but, you know, and just one by one, I went from reading, trying to decipher katakana names. And this is back in the days before computers, before Google or anything. So who the hell are we talking about here? Only to find that every person he mentioned then turned out to be listed up like in Ramon Schwab's La Renaissance Orientale or Edward Said's Orientalism. I mean, they were people, and they were significant people, and I didn't know anything about them. And it impressed me that in the 1890s he had found these people. So yes, he was pretty widely read in Western thought, and he did, I'm sure, choose his areas where he was more comfortable. Although he had in his personal life a rather unsatisfactory relationships with women, and he was never able to have a family. He was very interested in the cause of women's liberation and feminism. And he read stuff in that area. So he's a paradoxical figure, and he always just made me think and made me work hard to try to follow the trail of his thought. And he never led me any place that wasn't really fascinating. For example, the Schopenhauer material. I mean, I confess, Schopenhauer was, I think, in the 50s and 60s, the United States education system, he was just a name that was brought up and dismissed as a pessimist. When I first ran across him in Raven's work, I think I was here. I went to the Diet Library, looked up Schopenhauer. There were like two or three books on Schopenhauer, all written in the 1930s, and all just short, dismissing him as a pessimist. Well, come to find, I read the World as Will and Representation, and found out that this 1968 translation was a newer one than the old one, which was Haldane and Kemp, which was The World as Will and Idea, and or maybe was it Idea and Representation? No, I think it was Will and Idea. And so they realized that representation was a better English equivalent of the German than idea was. And then ever since that time, Schopenhauer has come in for more and more scrutiny in Western academic studies, so that in my bibliography, there's got to be 25 or 30 books on Schopenhauer. When I started, there was like three or four, and they were not very interesting. And now people, and there's a group in England that the Cambridge Press put out a new translation of The World as Will and Representation. And they have a long explanation about the former translator was this E.J.F. Pain or something like that. Everybody agrees he does a great job, but he was not an academic. He's a career military man. And so they thought, well, maybe it's time for academic philosophers to try to wade into the Schopenhauer waters. And so I don't know that their translation is significantly different than Pain's, but it's just interesting that he's coming in for that much more attention. And scholars, there's any number of books, and I think University of Hawaii put out some of these ones that deal with the Eastern-Western thing. And I think I say in the book that one of the things this turn of the against the modern is about is how ideas flow across from one culture to another, and how they're interpreted and how they're read. And because these ideas about Chinese philosophy were coming in fragments and fits and starts when Schopenhauer was, younger, in the early 1800s. And it was just, as far as they understood, Buddhism was a religion of somebody called Fo. And that's all they knew. And but when Schopenhauer ran across this idea of Maya, that everything that we see, what he calls representation, is simply that. It's the creation of the mind, which he took from Kant. But, it always seemed to me, and I'm not a philosopher, you are, but that Kant, came up with that, the thing in itself, the Ding An Sik. But he didn't know where to go from there about it. And Schopenhauer seemed to say, oh, there's a place to go, and you have to go inside to find that. And he maintained that he himself was no saint or no religious person, but that he could philosophically work out this problem, that there had to be a route to understand something deeper. He called that the will. And through understanding it, you could quiet the will and therefore transcend. And he apparently used to keep a statue of the Buddha and a statue of a bust of Plato. Those two were in his room and always referred to them. So I respect him a lot more than I did when I started, that he was a genuine, open to ideas from any time, any place.
Okay. It's probably a bit late, but it's never too late to talk about the structure of the book, the chapters of the book, because we mentioned the Schopenhauer chapter. Mm-hmm. If you could tell us a few things about how the book is structured.
Okay. Well, as you said, I tried to make it a biography, I guess an intellectual biography, but I found that it was hard to do it strictly chronologically because of just the way Talcoré's thoughts seem to evolve. But I did roughly, I think, structure it chronologically. But, his big moments, I guess, were times when he was in Tokyo in the Bundan, trying to, be in the world of ideas and to have little journals and magazines that he was either the leading writer for or the editor for. The challenge was they weren't very economically, viable. So he wound up living an existence of, pretty much hand to mouth. And a couple of times in his career, he left Japan and went to China, where he could be employed as a Japanese language teacher and also continue to read his Chinese thought and philosophy. And he had actually some students that, came to him and studied with him when he was in China. So I see him as this person who is representative of something in Meiji times, and that would be someone who had a pretty much a rough time of it. He stuck with what he believed in, but he was not rewarded for it. So I have a chapter that, in a way the story starts with his, after he got out of college, he was asked to edit this new magazine called Seinenbun, or Youth, Literary Youth. And that's when he took that position of saying writers should pay attention to the poor and the downtrodden and the new industrial working class and what's happening with them. He drew upon people like Yokoyama Genosuke and so forth, and Matsubara Iwagoro, and brought their works into his articles. But after, so he had these moments in the center of the literary world. They didn't last long. He was not influential. And so I conclude that chapter on the Seinenbun with the fact that Takayama Chogyu kind of came to Tokyo just as Talcoré was heading out the door to China. And he became what probably Talcoré would have liked to have been. He was writing for Taiyo magazine, what Kano Masanao calls a sogo zashi, comprehensive, lush-looking, beautiful photographs. And many considered Takayama Chogyu's writing to be exemplary, beautiful Japanese. And of course, he's a very, very much in favor of the state and the traditional, very conservative. And Takayama, he actually wrote this stuff about, social novels. Are you kidding me? Anybody who cares about social novels, an idiot, things like that. So complete opposite of Talcoré. But there you have it. Talcoré was out the door going to China, and Takayama Chogyu was, what would we say? It's his moment in the sun. He was the big hero figure. So it had to be discouraging, but Talcoré kept banging on it. And when he came back, he actually went back to China with the Japanese troops when they went for the Boxer Rebellion. He was what we'd call an embedded reporter, although the military didn't like the things that he wrote about it. So I think his stint there was cut short. But when he came back, he edited his own little journal called Tenko, or Heaven's Drum, which is where he started publishing all this stuff about what he thought needed to be the bunmei, the whole concept of Western civilization needed to be not just deconstructed, but attacked. And this is where he got kind of shrill, and his language, you know, probably won't impress some readers, but he's like saying, you know, this Bunmei stuff is way overrated. You know, it's really shallow. It has no substance. It doesn't go deep. It forces us to think only on the surface, and it makes us think about utilitarian things, and doesn't understand where, you know, what real human experience can be. It's too narrow. And so he just hammered away on that theme, probably, and that was right around 1905, 1906, 1907. Probably not a big audience for that line, although he, you know, he did write articles about the Furukawa Ichiban and the Ashino mine pollution disaster. And he was, of course, he was good friends with Kotoku Shusui. Kotoku Shusui had helped Tanaka Shozo draft that petition that he tried to give to the Meiji Emperor and was thrown in jail for. So he still had a, you know, always willing to stand up for what he thought was injustice. But he just kept, you know, trying to push his ideas and his readers to say, you know, why are we so obsessed with getting Bunmei and Bunmei Kaika? So kind of we get, you know, to the end of Takuren's story, and sadly he died very young. He didn't even reach age 41. You know, that was 10 years after Fukuzawa Yukichi had died, and I appreciated what the basically environmental historian Brett Walker wrote in his book about, called The Toxic Archipelago, was saying, you know, when we get, you know, to the end of the Ashio mine incident, you know, you look back and you realize that someone like Fukuzawa Yukichi relatively looks like an idiot, you know, compared to people who, he didn't mention Takuren, but someone like Takuren or anybody else, Kinoshita Naoe, you know, who was calling out, you know, the society and the government for letting this kind of industrial pollution destroy the land, destroy the people. And so, you know, as you know, Fukuzawa Yukichi remains revered in Japan today. He's on the Ichiman Yen note, and Takuren relatively ignored. But, you know, if you want to say who was right, I think Takuren was right. It's my opinion. That's why I love the guy, because I learned so much from him.
I have to confess that before reading your book, I didn't really know about Takuren. And when I saw the title, The Turn Against Modernity, mm-hmm. I was a bit puzzled and intrigued. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to read the book and to talk to you about it.
Good.
And my feeling was that even though the title of the book is The Turn Against Modernity, and you just talked about how Leon criticizes modernity and industrialization as being superficial and flawed and lacking in depth and so on and so forth. But my feeling was that he does criticize modernity or Bunmei, like Bunmei Kaika civilization and so on and so forth. What he also does is to suggest that the Western understanding of modernity, the Western understanding of civilization, is probably not the only one.
Oh, absolutely.
That we should look elsewhere as well. Yeah. We should look for clues and hints in China, in Japan, and so on. Am I correct in my understanding?
Yes, I believe you are. And he wrote a lot about how it should be the new world civilization, be a fusion of the best of East and West. And I think he believed in that. And what, again, startled me, I don't think I could appreciate it well when I first started reading him, but when he really got beyond the world of nation states and started talking and thinking in transnational terms and thinking that the world needs to move, you know, beyond where it is, and it needs to think about, you know, sort of independent, autonomous communities where individuals can, like, live free. And I think it, you know, in somewhere in the back of his mind, he probably thought of the ancient Chinese Taoist sage community as kind of a model. But, you know, we can't be fooled into thinking he wasn't aware of what modern life was like. I mean, he lived in Shanghai for a year, and he loved being in Shanghai. He loved the variety of racial and ethnic groups that he saw there. And I think to his credit, he saw that the future of the world is not going to be centered around nation states. We have to move beyond that and believe that autonomous individuals need to be the basis for a new kind of global transnational order. And I think I didn't really come to appreciate that until I was, working on this book. When I first was reading him, that was just, beyond quite what I could comprehend. And I really, and perhaps, the fact that other literature, we weren't talking about transnational history and Western historiography back in the 70s, and now it's something that's, everyone is talking about. So I'm looking, oh my gosh, Solis Tanqueray, and calling our attention to it. So I see him as a courageous person, someone who was willing, I guess you could say, to sacrifice a comfortable life for a rather challenging life as a renegade intellectual. And, the idea of giving himself over to working for these small journals that had little chance of, making anybody any money, usually depended on some, patron to, give them some capital to start up. And, it was a tough life. He could have chosen other things. He had a couple of brothers who worked for big companies like Mitsui and Mitsubishi and so forth, and they helped him out financially. But, intellectually, I think he was worlds apart from them, and he wasn't going to compromise what he believed in. For that, I give him credit.
Another topic that you talk about, you discuss in your book, is the subject of modernity.
Yes, yes.
The notion of the self.
Yes.
That being proposed or suggested.
Yes.
And you also mention the fact that this is a topic that's that there's this line of thought that you cannot really talk about the notion of self in Japan because of this idea of
everything's group,
the
collective,
really group oriented culture. What is Ryan's, what is the subject of modernity in his vision? What is the self in his vision?
Well, I think it's a very complicated question. I think he had a lot of it, got a lot of it from his reading of Schopenhauer, who talked a lot about the self and how we operate human beings as kind of a system that perceives things, and we take in these inputs from the environment, and then this is kind of sounds like the Buddha's teaching as well, and then it pushes us into these directions with all these desires to consume, and to achieve and to gain material happiness. And then the Buddha's teaching was that, that will never get you anywhere. And, I love the line. I think there's a documentary film that everyone talks about in the life of the Buddha where they use as the title a quote that he had, "Remember me as someone who woke up." And I think, I feel like Tao Kering was trying to beat this drum. That's Heaven's Drum was the title of his journal, where he was at his most shrill, trying to ring a bell, trying to wake up his fellow Japanese and say, you can't do anything until you start coming to terms with your individual self. And that means you have to be able to, to look inside. So we talk a lot about subjectivity. And I think he was, in his own way, guided mostly by Schopenhauer. Like many Japanese, he did a little Zazen practice. He said it wasn't really for him. But, if you don't spend some time with your focus on an inner self, then you're not really part of the larger concerns of the universe. And so I think for him, he maybe rooted his understanding of individual and of subjectivity and of human freedom and human experience in this idea that that's what we're here for. We're only given what we're given, which is this body and this mind. If we don't use that to investigate ourselves, then we probably will never learn anything or never go anywhere. And that seems like also very contemporary, you know, modern psychology and so forth seems to, you know, confirm that perception. So again, I think he was, in many ways, he kind of was a forerunner of the New Age, you know, movement. I mentioned that, you know, not only Lao Tzu and Zhuangzi, but he was quite a fan of the I Ching, you know, the Book of Changes. And that's another area where people are, I think, coming to greater and greater appreciation of that book as a book of wisdom. So the getting around back to the individual subjectivity and what you said, yes, it's people want to say that in Japan it's very difficult for individualism to thrive. But and I pondered it maybe because he was from Tosa, he was from Kochi, and Kotokushu is from Shusu is from the same area. But they grew up at the peak of the popular rights movement, the Jiyomingendo, and they were all about freedom and individuality. And so that's why I think I kind of end the book up with some references to Maruyama Masao and the post-war debate on subjectivity. And as I understand that, many critics, you know, right after the war, they wanted to know why didn't Japanese do a better job of standing up to the state in the 1930s and saying no, you know, to overseas adventurism, you know, no to imperialism. And many concluded that their sense of self, subjectivity, just wasn't developed enough. Shutaisei, that we translate that as subjectivity. But I think Maruyama saw in, you know, Taoko Reimun and maybe Tokutomi Roka, a few other people, Ishikawa Sanshiro, some of that. No, they had some of that subjectivity, and they had some of the guts that it took to look and to learn and to study and to keep themselves focused on something that was, you know, other than their own material improvement. And I feel like Maruyama did recognize Taupere, but I feel like, yeah, he's a good case in point that well before the 1930s, he was trying to point his fellow Japanese in the direction of, you know, don't look the other way when it comes to the inner self. Don't be afraid of it. You got to deal with it.
Why was the self so important to him? This is actually one of the questions that you yourself ask in the introduction.
And that's a tough one to answer. He does, one thing we haven't talked about, and it does affect your question about the structure of the book, which I didn't really answer very well, but he did write an autobiography when he was dying. He knew he was dying of spinal meningitis. He serialized it in Chuokoron in the day. So that was his moment in the sun. And after he finished writing it, he was still alive, and so he started publishing supplements to it until the day he died. So it was hard not to, as I wrote, to think about his own memoir, his own thought about himself. And he talked about some days when he, his education, he had a very fragmented education. He really wanted to go to what was called, I think, the Kochi Kyoritsu Gakko. It was a school run by the Jiyomingendo, the popular rights movement, where they could study Mill and Locke in English and really get into what we would call human rights, what's the natural rights. But then for some reason, he decided to leave that school and to go to a middle school in Osaka. And while there, Mori Arinori became the minister of education, and he immediately started having the young students do military drills every day. And Taupurein was like, what? That's not why I came here. And so he rebelled against the system, and his fellow students encouraged him. They didn't have as much courage. So he kept getting punished for, you know, bad behavior. And so he developed kind of like probably an ulcer and high tension. And so he had to withdraw, like many Japanese intellectuals do. He had to withdraw and spend some time at home in bed and even in the hospital. And while he was doing that, he said he went through a period where he actually had out-of-body experiences, and he could look down and see the self, and he could see what he was and who he was. And then the night he came home from the hospital, his father, with whom he got, you know, very loving family, I guess, and he loved his father. His father had a stroke and died almost immediately. So these were heavy times for him. And again, he said he, you know, he went deep in. He became, you know, depressed, and he had to fight his way out of that. And it's when he realized that, yes, he had to get sort of back in the game, that he wanted to find a way to resume his education. So he went to Tokyo and joined a school of fisheries, of all things, which was a vocational school. He said, I didn't know anything about, you know, fish or anything, but he was a smart young man and he could get excellent scores on all the written work. He said he didn't do very well when they were like raising fish in the hatcheries, that he didn't know what to do. But that completing that program became a stepping stone to go to Tokyo Bunka Daigaku, where he could get into a Chinese studies program because they were certifying young people to teach basically would be middle school ethics in the form of Confucian teachings. But I did a little digging around on what the curriculum was, and clearly he went way beyond the curriculum of what it took to get certified, because they didn't want people reading necessarily Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu and the Book of Changes, but he was all into that. And then he had one brief experience where he tried teaching ethics to middle school kids, but that wasn't his thing either. So I think that experience of illness, and he wrote about it, and I think when he read Schopenhauer, then he could understand a little more what Schopenhauer was saying about there's really like there's two parts to the human self. You know, one part is all conditioned by the environment, but there's another part that can be found and discovered. And I think Taupin and Phil, I've already got a glimpse of that. Interestingly to me, Roman, throughout his life, he always wrote that he was never religious or spiritual. You know, tried a little Zen, and he wrote about the Bible and Jesus and the Gospel. So he knew this stuff, knew a little bit about Islam, but he claimed none of these things were anything that, you know, convinced him to become a religious person. But in some of his writings, he took on people who did write in that area and would have Ronsoro's arguments with them.
But I got the feeling from your book that he was a very compassionate human being.
He was.
And you write about his criticism of the Western scientific view of reality, which in his view lacked depth and comprehensiveness, and he actually talks about how this Western scientific view it basically has no ideals, and as such it has no capacity to care for the fate of fellow human beings. So he in a way he argued for this empathy towards other human beings.
And he, you know, the word he used in Japanese was dojo, which was obviously rooted in Schopenhauer's notion of Mitleid, it was often translated as sympathy, but I found compassion or empathy was a much better word. Dojo, of course, in Japanese means same feelings, you know, feelings aligned, but that would, two people, when one person can align their feelings with another, then they can have empathy and understand a fellow human being. So, yeah, he was very moved by that concept in Schopenhauer of Mitleid, of compassion, understanding. And that's what he wanted writers to have. And I think and it was very Confucian as well, right? Because if you were Confucianist and you believed in run, then that's compassionate understanding of other human beings. And you know, Confucius's point of departure was you can't do anything or be anything in this world if you don't start there. And I think Taupin where, though not a Confucianist, I think he's very open to that idea. And he would link Confucian's run, Jesus's eye, Jesus's love, and Schopenhauer's, Mitleid. These are all related concepts. When you consider that, in a way, he wasn't highly educated, his education was fragmented. Yes, he wound up at one of the best universities in Japan, Meiji Japan, but he was in a sidetracked into a minor program. I think nobody took the people in his department of Chinese studies terribly seriously. Everybody wanted to study Western stuff and Western philosophy, but you could make that argument that, no, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And we haven't mentioned Indian philosophy, but he also talked about the Vedas and the Upanishads quite a bit, and who see the whole network. I mean, the Vedas and the Upanishads come for another 400 or 500 years before Chinese philosophy. He's saying, we got to study it all. They knew things back then. We seem to have forgotten them. He wanted his readers to go back, which, since he was addressing audiences which were trying to get the latest technology and get that under control and learn techniques for achieving this or that, probably nobody cared much what Tao Te Ching said. But I think if we look back at him now, I think we marvel at, wow, he actually was really on those things. And proof is that he was willing to do whatever he had to do to keep his practice alive, to keep reading, keep studying. And that's why I think his memoir or his autobiography was probably compelling to readers, because there he was dying. He had lost the use of his legs, and he was still working, still fighting, still struggling to understand the self, understand the times in which he lived. Didn't say exactly what Marshall Berman said. I think he would have been completely understood that whole line of modernity places us, catapults us into this crazy environment where we, at the one hand, we see all this promise and power and energy. We could do anything at the same time. Oh, it could all fall apart on us as well. Since, again, he's writing this before weapons of mass destruction and so forth, it's still rather prophetic in a certain way.
Since you mentioned the self, yes, again.
Did I really?
And modernity. The last chapter of your book is called Last Thoughts on Defending the Modern Self. Mm-hmm. And my question was, in the end, for Lei Yun, what did becoming modern mean for him? If he criticizes the Western paradigm.
Right. I think he's saying that in alone is not enough. And I quoted, some articles where he would write very approvingly and excitedly about modern ideas and modern technologies. And, he was not alone, but people in the 19th century and early 20th century thought things like animal magnetism, might be very helpful, using magnets, to heal, ill people. And he thought that hypnotism might be a way for individual subjects to sort of turn off that focus on all the stimuli that come in and distract us from what's really real. He thought maybe that would be a great tool. So he got all caught up in modern things as well. He wasn't a fool, but he wasn't willing to accept these things uncritically. He wanted to say, what do they lack, though? What are they missing? And I mentioned way in the beginning how, as a graduate student in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s in Asian studies, we couldn't fail to be aware of Joseph Levinson's work at Berkeley. He died tragically in a boating accident in the prime of his career, but he had written his trilogy about Confucianism and its modern fate in China. And then he wrote that little book about Liang Qichao, and the mind of modern China. And I couldn't help feeling as though, you know, it took Liang Qichao in China until World War I to get where Reagan had already gotten in the 1890s, which was, there's a lot of cool things about 19th century Western civilization, but it's not the end all to everything because it comes up short. You know, it's strong on materialism and wealth and power. It's what the Chinese were so interested in, but you know, it'll sell you down the river. You know, you have to sell your soul and you're going to lose that sort of holistic perspective on the human experience, and the whole world will be shallower and less beautiful. And Liang Qichao came to understand that after, you know, struggling mightily with a lot of those questions about becoming modern. So I guess I don't know for sure, you know, what becoming modern means. I think I wrote somewhere there's a consensus that we kind of all agree with, that, you know, the Industrial Revolution is a big part of it. Before the Industrial Revolution, you know, the world was one kind of place, but after, you know, the internal combustion engine and all these factories becoming powered by inanimate energy, enabling large numbers of workers to congregate. But then they live a life where their work is routinized and they only do one task. We haven't talked about Edward Carpenter, who was a big influence on Japan, on Tom Cordeon, because he had written this notion that the civilization is a kind of a disease that humanity has to pass through. They have to sink down and have another fall, I guess, like Adam and Eve, and then come out of it and realize that, you know, he was kind of an original hippie. He was also an out of the closet homosexual, and he wrote about gender relations and same sex love, and he probed into the nature of that. And he was, Tao Cordain read his writings, and I think he felt like, I've got a soulmate here in Edward Carpenter, who understood that civilization, the direction it's taking us, is not a good end point for human beings. So I think people agree that modernization does mean urbanization, industrialization. It means the spread of popular movements, ideas about individual freedoms and subjectivity. But, you know, even today, you know, who's modern, who's not modern? You know, I don't know that we fully understand that, but definitely there is a process. And, we can say now in 2018 that it's a universal experience. So everybody around the world, no one can now escape from modernity. And the countries in Asia in the 19th century, they didn't have a choice because modernity was forced upon them by Western imperialism. And most of the late developing societies didn't have a choice, really, one way or the other. Trade, contact with the West, extraction of resources from Africa, Latin America, and then the realization of, well, if we don't figure out how to do some of this stuff ourselves, we're always just going to be taken advantage of. So societies felt we must come to deal with the modern. And so for most places, it probably involves a mixture of things that they want to preserve from their own traditions and culture, and adaptations that they need to make in order to survive in this cruel, multicultural, trans-historical, global world. Environmentalism comes in a bit too here in a way, and Tao Cordeon actually had a couple of essays where he was also prescient about that. But pollution doesn't know national boundaries. One of the reasons I think Japan looks better today, the sky and everything, to me, than it did in the 1970s is, well, a lot of the factories have moved to China, but now the wind blows the acid rains back, from China to Japan, and they're like, oh no, that's there. But you can't just put up walls and stop that. So somehow I think Tao Cordeon, as a young person in the 1890s and early 1900s, he was able to somehow intuit that, wow, this thing about becoming modern is a lot more to it than just rushing in and reading a few Western philosophers and finding out new strategies for business and economics and reorganizing government, that there's more at stake. It does have to do with, like you say, how can you be fully realized human beings with the right kind of intellectual, emotional configuration that enables us to live in the world and move fully and get the most out of our lives.
If you want your readers to take one thing from you, from your book, what would that be?
Well, I think it's a tough question, but I think, you know, to think about, read for yourself, and Tao Te Ching wouldn't want anything less. Read for yourself and see what you think and see what you can take from that. What does he teach us? What does he tell us about the modern experience and the human experience on this planet in this time? His time was late 19th, early 20th century. We're now in the 21st century. Does anything that he has to say have meaning for us today? And if so, what is it? Some things he highlighted, projects he wanted to do if he could have lived longer. And, one of them was to dig more into the question of gender relations and liberation of women and the equality between the sexes. And the other was he wanted to do a thoroughgoing translation of Schopenhauer into Japanese. He said, I may not be the guy to do this because I'm not really a philosopher, but he would work on it if he had time, and because he felt like, this was often the case in Meiji Japan, fragmentary translations were made and summaries were made, but he wanted to actually go into the world as will and representation, translate the whole thing into Japanese. That kind of dedication, that kind of willingness to, put the time and effort into it. So I'd like ordinary people who might read this book to think about what Tao Te Ching has to say. I'd like my students to understand that scholarship is hard work, and, you have to roll up your sleeves and get in there, get into those archives and dig in. And I mean, it took me whatever it is, 45 years, to bring this study to completion. Now, I had a nice, wonderful holiday in the sense that after reading Tao Te Ching's writings as best I could, and particularly reading his memoir, his autobiography, I went off to study autobiography in general. And I did two books on women's writing in the modern period, one pre-war, one post-war. And, in a way, each one of those women that I read, and I translated some of the portions of their memoirs, it was a mini version of what I was doing with Tao Te Ching, in the sense that I had to learn so many new things to understand their lives and their times, talking about 1920s and 30s and then in the post-war years, that I felt like, just like I feel like Tao Te Ching was kind of a teacher to me, I feel like all these women that I read, and excerpts of their autobiographies are in my book called, two books called Telling Lives, and the second one's called Changing Lives. But everyone, and there are many more that I read that didn't, couldn't find their way into the book. But every one of those women I learned something from. I learned, much more about gender relations, and I learned about what life was like in the Taisho and early Showa years, and what life was like in the post-war years, and learning more like about the Lucky Dragon incident and the Bikini Atoll. And now it seems a colleague I know at Harvard, I mean, he and his students are studying the whole Bikini Atoll story from the point of view of the islanders who got moved off of that island so they could test. But of course, the Lucky Dragon incident too. And it's such a rich kind of thing. And I think as historians, we have to look back and find our little spot where hopefully we dig in. And when we dig in, that hole takes us deep. I mean, that's what Tao Te Ching did. He takes you deep. And I think as a scholar, you want to be able to go deep. And as a teacher, you want to be able to go deep.
Well, just a short question about Tao Te Ching, because if I understand correctly, this book has been in the making for 30 years?
Oh, more than
more than 30 years.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I started it as a dissertation project in 72 to 75.
It's a long
yeah, and then so
40
yeah,
something years.
25, 30. Yeah, 40 some years. Yeah. Almost as long as he lived. I mean, as long as he lived, more than his life. Yeah. And as I was saying earlier, I couldn't have written this book back then. And the scholarship on things like modernity, on things like Schopenhauer, I think also like the world of small journals and the literary critics. So there's a rich literature on all of that, which you kind of, it's helpful to have to then appreciate what, you know, I saw here in Tao Pa Dei. It's too easy to, you know, read his a paragraph that he summarizes his take on Schopenhauer and say, okay, well, that's that, and I'm not going to go any deeper into Schopenhauer. He liked Schopenhauer, so what? Nobody else does, whatever. But so I wound up, you know, not only reading Schopenhauer in English translation, but then keeping my eye on, you know, the scholarship and finding that, you know, as I said earlier, when I started in the early 70s, two, three, four books on Schopenhauer could be listed in a library catalog. Now it's got to be 40 or 50, and people are taking them seriously. I still don't think, I don't know about in Europe, but in the United States, probably most, there's very few philosophy departments where there would be like a course on Schopenhauer. He's likely to show up in a, you know, in a survey course and probably not get the attention he deserves. But obviously, from this scholarship, there's a few people, like there's somebody at the University of Wisconsin who seems pretty serious, Schopenhauer scholar, and people all over the world. So I feel like, you know, yeah, he's a unique case. I mean, everybody knows Kant and everybody knows Plato and Tao Pa Dei, talked a lot about them, but Schopenhauer doesn't get the credit. And Tao Pa Dei said, well, he should. And now I'm saying the same thing. I think he should.
And this is actually one of the things that I felt reading your book, that Leon, he's not part of the pantheon. He's not one of the major intellectual figures of Meiji Japan. He's not like Fuzawa Yukichi. He's not on any of the
currency.
Currency, yeah.
Absolutely.
But I felt reading your book, I felt throughout the book this idea that he is an important thinker, and we should read him. We should listen to what he has to say.
Thank you, and I appreciate bringing that up. And again, that's another thing that was hard about choosing someone like Tao Pa Dei, because he was a marginalized thinker. In fact, he was called a wasurareta shisoka by Ienaga, forgotten, and somewhat because his writings were suppressed. We didn't really talk about that, but out of his 8 volumes of criticism, 4 of them were banned. So, you know, the idea is so prominent that, you know, a person has to be influential to be worth studying. But that doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, maybe the people who are pushed to one side and are ignored are the more interesting people, because they teach you something about what maybe just a few people thought about the times. But if they were really on the side that was right, then you know, that's a better thing. I remember back in the day when I had finished my dissertation and I was visiting campuses, being interviewed for jobs. I visited a college, and one of the people there was a Harvard PhD, and he wore the ascots and everything. And we were having dinner and wine. And he's going, well, do you think that Tao Pa Dei, you know, has the gray matter, you know, to be, you know, a serious intellectual? And I felt like saying, you know, what a pompous attitude that is. You know, the point is, however large or small or whatever his brain is, he worked hard. He wrote every day. He read every day. He told us a little bit about his style of work. And it's very, I suppose, very Japanese, because after reading about something, and it was time to write when he was on, like, editing a journal, he had a deadline. So he would close up all the books. You know, a lot of people like to keep the books open. I do, you know, but but he would close everything up. And it was either in his mind and he could handle it or it wasn't. And then that's how he did his work. So I think this idea that you have to be widely appreciated in your time or you're not worth studying is really bogus. And in fact, we can learn more from the kind of people who were ignored. So I think don't be afraid, I would say to young scholars, to take on people who are not well known. In fact, that's our job, is to make them better known. And that's why I really appreciated coming across Sho Konishi's book called Anarchist Modernity, because he wasn't afraid to say that, there was this community. He guesstimates about 6,000 Meiji intellectuals who were not all on the same page, but they all shared a lot of common values. They were concerned about what was going on. They didn't think society was looking right. They didn't think, the promise of modernity was going to really be all that people thought it was going to be. And some were socialists, some were communists, some were anarchists, some were Christians, some were pacifists. And you had people like Kinoshita Naoe, who was a Christian, a pacifist, and a socialist all in one. And, I don't think Kinoshita Naoe has been that well studied. And Ishikawa Sanjiro is another. He was influenced by Christianity, but also influenced deeply by Edward Carpenter. And he went to England and hung out with Edward Carpenter for a while. Plus, he was in a long-term relationship with Fukuda Hideko, who was an older than him. So he was the young lover of a woman who had been involved in popular rights movement. She was arrested for trying to go to Korea and start a revolution. She had carrying a bomb on a ferry, and she was sentenced to jail. And only her sentence got commuted when the Meiji Constitution was instituted. But she came back, and she started a journal of global feminism and everything. So, there were people like that, and they've always interested me much more than studying established writers or people who are, businessmen or ministers of finance or whatever. Frankly, I could care less about those people. They're boring to me. But people who lived on the edge, marginalized people who, like Tao Raven, as far as I can tell, he never really wore Western clothes. All the pictures show him in kimono. And but it doesn't mean he was, he said, don't think of me as a throwback, someone who hates being in the modern world, because he did, but he just wanted people to be mindful of, what was there. And I love the fact that when he went to China and went to Shanghai, he realized that his worldview up to that time had been somewhat limited. He used the metaphor of the frog in a well. He was in a huge non-Western city with a mix of people and buildings and traffic. He didn't hate that. You might think that someone interested in Taoism that he just want to live back in nature or something, but not so much. And Sho Konishi has done some work on, I think his name is Ogawa Yusen, an anarchist artist, printmaker, stuff like that. He and Tao Raven met and were quite good friends, and they collaborated on a book together where Yusen did the drawings and Tao Raven. It was called Yuzo Muzo, language and silence. And then Tao Raven would write the little short, almost poem like words, and then Yusen would write do the images. It was very cool stuff. So they were kind of pushing the envelope. Those kind of people interest me much more than other kinds of people.
Well, Ronald, we've taken up a lot of your time. I still have one final question.
Absolutely.
It's actually about the future. What's on the horizon for you? Mm-hmm. Are you working on a new project right now?
Funny you should ask. I'm actually retired at the end of this semester, although I don't feel very retired because, as I told you, I'm over here with a program. So anyway, I've decided to step back from teaching. And maybe my next project is to take this biography of Tao Kereung and play around with a little bit and try my hand at some historical fiction. Not going to limit it to his years, because I want to go broader and not limit it to Japan, but to try to include China. So I've never written fiction before, and I probably would want to know a lot more. I've been to China a little bit, but I think I should probably spend a little more time in China getting to appreciate, maybe follow some of the paths that Tao Pereira was on. So I might try my hand at that. Otherwise, I'll try to just be a person who lives a little bit holistically, harmoniously, be on my bike, be in the gym exercising. And, you know, I think I will always spend an hour or two every day studying Japanese, practicing writing my kanji, because, you know, we talk in America at liberal arts colleges about lifelong learning. Well, anyone who gets into Japanese studies has the opportunity, right?
To do lifelong
learning. So that's kind of my story. I'm 72 years old, and I've had a career of about 41 years of teaching. So it's time to move on and do other things.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ronald.
It's a pleasure.
For everybody, this was our conversation with Ronald Loftus about his book, The Turn Against the Modern, The Critical Essays of Tao Karaion, which was published by the Association for Asian Studies in 2017. Thank you again. And, well, Ronald, good luck with your plans for the future.
Thank you very much, Ronald.
And thank you for the conversation today.
It was my pleasure, and I hope your listeners will run out and get my book on Tao Karaion, but more importantly, just reflect on some of these things. It can't hurt you.
Thank you.